From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, Art and Politics, Abdullah Ibrahim tells us about writing his composition Mandela. And we hear from Raul Julia, star of the films Kiss of the Spider Woman, Romero, and Mac the Knife. Also today, filmmaker Michael Romer tells us why it took more than 20 years for his movie The Plot Against Harry to make it to the screen. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the miniseries about the Kennedys. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. In Cape Town, Nelson Mandela held his first news conference today since being released from prison. Meanwhile, thousands of supporters are waiting for Mandela outside his Soweto home. As NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports, the dancing and singing continue into the wee morning hours.
The people, including many teenagers and children, have been here since Saturday when they learned of his release. Today, tens of thousands gathered at a Soweto stadium, hoping to hear Mandela speak. There were reports that several children were injured as thousands more crowded in. Many fainted in the heat from lack of water and food. Organizers finally announced that Mandela would not appear. Later, the ANC passed out flyers, urging people not to go to the Mandela home, but to attend another rally planned for tomorrow. But still, an expectant crowd waits to see Mandela walk through the door of his house. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Soweto.
At a White House news conference this afternoon, President Bush said, despite Pretoria's release of Nelson Mandela and other reforms, it's too soon to consider lifting U.S. economic sanctions. The Coast Guard has granted permission for the ruptured oil tanker American Trader to be moved tonight to Long Beach, California. The vessel has been moored off Huntington Beach, California, since it spilled hundreds of thousands of gallons of crude oil last week. The resulting black goo is washing into sensitive bird sanctuary areas, and authorities fear that an approaching storm front could further spread the pollution along the Southern California coastline. Israel's Minister of Trade and Industry, Ariel Sharon, resigned from the government today during a stormy meeting of his rightist governing Likud Party Central Committee. Patricia Golan reports that Sharon was challenging the leadership of Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir over his handling of the Israeli peace initiative.
The crucial Likud meeting broke up in an uproar 90 minutes after it began, with opposing factions screaming each other down. Ariel Sharon dropped his bombshell that he was resigning from the government. Prime Minister Shamir defended himself against charges that he was betraying the ideals of the party in following his peace initiative. Hardliners within his Likud party have attacked Shamir for his proposals for holding elections in the Israeli-occupied territories, which they fear will compromise Israel's security. Shamir demanded a show of confidence, while Sharon simultaneously shouted his demands to eradicate terror. In the chaos, no one knew who had voted for what. The party meeting broke up with everyone claiming victory, but without a clear indication of Israel's direction in the peace process. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Prices were lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 29 points to close at 2619.14. Declines led advances 5-2 in light trading of 118 million shares. This is NPR News. A state of emergency and a nighttime curfew have been imposed in the capital of the Soviet Republic of Tajikistan, where protests over rumored resettlement of ethnic Armenian refugees degenerated into riots. There are reports of dozens killed and injured in the unrest. It's the first indication that the ethnic violence which racked Azerbaijan last month had spread. Tajikistan, like Azerbaijan, is predominantly Muslim. Armenians who fled Azerbaijani assaults are mostly Christian. Rebel forces of the Eritrean People's Liberation Army claim they have captured the strategic port city of Mesela and say they are now fighting a fierce battle to take the main Ethiopian base in the city of Karen. Richard O'Regan reports.
The loss of the port means the government forces in Eritrea are now cut off and can only be resupplied by air. The rebels already control 85% of the province, and the road links to Eritrea have long been cut by other rebel groups, also fighting the Soviet-backed Mengistu government. The attacks come in the midst of the worst drought and food shortages that Eritrea has seen since the catastrophic famine of 1984 and 5. Food shortages that all sides say are caused more by 30 years of warfare than by this season's drought. For National Public Radio, this is Richard O'Regan in Khartoum, Sudan.
In Lebanon, the forces of Christian General Michel Aoun battled in the hills around Beirut today with Lebanese forces militiamen. There were also battles in the streets of East Beirut, according to police. Under pressure to decisively strike at the smaller LF militia, Aoun has so far been unable to break through their defenses. The violent struggle for control of Lebanon's Christian enclave claimed another life today, bringing the death toll to 458 since the intra-Christian war erupted on January 30th. In New York, a federal judge has given bankrupt Eastern Airlines just 8 more days to submit a reorganization plan. Sharon Green in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Coming up, an interview with actor Raul Julia. But first, Nelson Mandela is free after 27 years in prison. His resistance during his long incarceration inspired much music, literature, and art. One such composition was written by the exiled black South African composer and pianist Abdullah Ibrahim. You may also know him by the name he used to record under, Dollar Brand. He's lived in exile in the U.S. for 14 years. He's the South African composer who's had the greatest impact on jazz in the U.S., and his music has been very popular in South Africa. His song Mannenberg became the theme of the 1976 Soweto Uprising. His composition, Mandela, was recorded back in 1985, before Mandela's release seemed imminent. The music always struck me as surprisingly upbeat. In a phone conversation with Ibrahim this morning, he explained why.
This is part of a suite. That was one movement from the suite. And hopefully we would like to perform it for Nelson and Winnie and the people of South Africa soon. But the piece specifically is joyous and a call to rally and a call to celebrate in spite of all, because we had thought about it. That was written about, how long, 7 years ago? Because we were focusing on this day, and that the idea of our leaders languishing in prison should not make us despondent. It should rather be a sense of strength.
Abdullah Ibrahim's composition Mandela from his 1985 recording Water from an Ancient Well. This is Fresh Air. My guest Raul Julia has escaped the typecasting that many Latino actors are subject to. In The Kiss of the Spider Woman, he starred as a political prisoner in a Latin American dictatorship. He played the brains behind the dictator in the comedy Moon Over Parador. In Tequila Sunrise, he was the zesty drug connection, and in compromising positions, he investigated the murder of a lecherous dentist. On stage, Julia starred in the Broadway musical Nine and played McHeath in the Joseph Papp production of the Threepenny Opera. He also plays McHeath in the new film version of the Threepenny Opera, Mack the Knife. Last year, Raul Julia played the title role in the movie Romero, which was based on the life of the Archbishop of El Salvador, who was assassinated in 1980 while saying Mass. I asked Julia if any of his beliefs were challenged by playing a man who stood up against the government.
I wouldn't say so much as challenged as enhanced. because I believe that what Romero's stand and ideology was the correct one. Romero really was not a political ideologist. He was a humanist, and he was just for the betterment of the poor and the oppressed and the people that were being tortured and unjustly put in prison. So that's what I really, my stand as far as these things are concerned are really pretty much like Romero's. It's really what works for humanity and not any specific ideology, political ideology.
Raul Julia is my guest, and he stars in the new movie Romero. He plays the assassinated Archbishop of El Salvador. You know, I want to ask you. I'm mentioning your name as Raul Julia, and I think most people say Raul Julia. Do you care when people mispronounce your name? Does it bother you? Because it happens all the time. I've also heard a lot of people say Raul Julia.
I know it happens a lot, and I mean, I'm not going to have a heart attack over it, but it would be nice if it was pronounced the correct way. And if people say Julia, then it's better if they say Julia, because Julia is in Spanish, Julia is in Catalan, and either way is fine.
Okay. Now, I think a great study in contrast is your role as Oscar Romero and your role as McHeath in the Pat production of the Three Penny Opera, which I believe you're also making into a movie now.
Yes.
As McHeath, you know, you're a morally depraved sexual sadist and gangster.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do to get the body language right for that? Because there's so much you have to convey through your gestures and posture.
For Mac the Knife?
Yeah.
Well, I got a direction from the director of Three Penny Opera at that time, and it was to walk like a crab and during rehearsals. And I started walking like that, and then it turned out to be like a catwalk. It evolved into walking like a cat, and that was part of the outward feeling of the character. And then inside, I just worked on the worst, you know, those aspects that are we contain inside of us, that are anger and murder and hate and complete disgust with life and things. You have to bring those things up inside of you.
The only role I've ever heard you sing in was MacHeath in Three Penny Opera.
Mm-hmm.
And in a moment, I want to play an excerpt of one of your recordings from the New York Shakespeare production cast album of that.
Oh, my God, you're going to play that. I can't believe it. I haven't heard that in 10 years.
Well, when you took on this role, did you think of yourself as a singer? Had you sung in other roles?
Yeah, I had. I actually had. I'm more an actor than a singer, so I'm always a little nervous when my voice is going to be played. But go ahead.
What the heck, huh?
What the heck?
Okay, this is Raul Julia in the Ballad of Immoral Earnings.
There was a time now very far away when we set up together, I and she. I had the brains and she supplied the breast. I did her right and she supported me. A way of life then, if not quite the best. And when a client came, I'd slide out of her bed and treat him nice and go and have a drink instead. And when he paid up, I'd address him, sir, come anytime you feel you fancy her. The time's gone past, but what would I not give to see that whorehouse where we used to live?
Do you think of yourself as approaching singing as an actor?
Yeah, I think I'm more, my purpose has always been more into acting, although I love singing, and I like to work on my singing as much as I can. I really do. So, you know, it's like singing is my favorite thing after acting,
mm-hmm.
and I take the opportunity to do it anytime I can.
Now, you're making the movie version of Three Penny Opera now, right?
Yeah, we finished it already.
Now, you're playing the same role 14 years or so after you played it on Broadway.
13,
okay. So does this mean that you're going to be playing it any differently?
Oh, yes. This film version is completely a different interpretation from the one I did on Broadway. The one on Broadway was Richard Foreman, this one is Menachem Golan. So there's two very different directors with very different, completely, totally different concepts.
Well, I want to talk with you more, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Raul Julia, who has starred in the films Kiss of the Spider-Woman, Moon Over Parador, Tequila Sunrise. He's about to come out in the Three Penny Opera. And he stars as the assassinated Archbishop of El Salvador, Oscar Romero, in the new film Romero. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Julia is my guest, and I want to ask you a couple of questions about your film Kiss of the Spider-Woman, which was released in 1985. I want to play a clip from the film first. This is about two cellmates in a Latin American prison. You play a political prisoner who's dedicated himself to a cause and is willing to sacrifice all personal pleasure to achieve the cause. William Hurt co-stars as your cellmate. He's a gay man who's a sensualist and is willing to sacrifice anything for love. This is a scene in which William Hurt offers you part of his avocado.
Have some. It's delicious.
No, thanks.
Sure, you don't like it?
Sure, I like it, but no thanks.
Well, then go ahead and have some. It's a long time till lunch.
Can't afford to get spoiled.
Do you really think that eating this avocado will make you spoiled and weak? Enjoy what life offers you.
What life offers me is the struggle.
And you're dedicated to that.
Pleasure becomes secondary.
Does your girlfriend think the same thing?
How do you know I have a girl?
It's the normal thing. Does she avoid pleasure too?
She knows what really counts. That the most important thing is serving a cause that is noble.
What kind of a cause is that? One that doesn't let you eat an avocado?
Molly, now you would never understand.
I understand one thing. I offer you half of my precious avocado and you throw it back in my face.
Don't act like that. You sound just like a...
Like a what? Say it. Say it. Like a woman, you mean. What's wrong with being like a woman?
You were so interested in making this movie, Kiss of the Spider-Woman, that you were willing to do it, I think, was it with no pay or with just no...
No profit? Pay.
No pay.
Yeah, okay. No, we didn't...
Expenses, but no salary.
Expenses, but no salary, that's right, yeah.
Is that something you would ever do again?
I'll do it if it's a good enough project, yes.
Has everybody been calling you up, knowing that you'd be willing to go that far for a movie you believed in, thinking, well, he'll love my movie, and maybe he'll do it for free?
Oh, I get a lot of... Yeah, I get that, yeah. But, you know, it depends. It's a matter of loving the project, and Bill Hurt did it too. I mean, if it's a good enough project, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm. Actor Raul Julia is my guest. Now, you grew up in San Juan, where I believe your father owned a restaurant?
Yeah.
What kind of restaurant was it?
My father was the first man to bring pizzas to Puerto Rico.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Were they good? I mean, now that you tasted New York pizza, were they good?
They're the best. They're still the best. It's still there, and the best pizzas in the world are there in Puerto Rico.
So was it a fancy restaurant or a pizzeria with pizza by the slice?
It was sort of like neither fancy nor a pizzeria. It's sort of like middle of the road. It was built up like a cave, like a Spanish gypsy cave. And he had the pizzas there, also chicken in the basket, which he was he was the first one to bring chicken in the basket too. You know, the chicken with the French fries all around it.
Right.
And it was a big hit, and it still is, and it's still there. The best chicken in the world, too. Really good chicken, good pizzas. And it's called La Cueva del Chicken Inn.
That's great.
And it's when you go to Puerto Rico, you must go.
So you must have been exposed to a lot of different influences when you were growing up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we would meet a lot of people that would come from the States or from Europe, and
mm-hmm.
you know, so we were exposed to a lot of, also the culture in Puerto Rico. My mother, you made sure we would go to the opera and to the ballet and to. I remember seeing Arthur Rubinstein play in Puerto Rico when I was probably 9 years old or something like that. So I was exposed to many things, thank God. Also, I remember doing Shakespeare when I was in high school, reading Shakespeare for the first time in English when I was in high school. And then I took to it, and that's afterwards I decided to be an actor, and I already had some leeway with Shakespeare because I always liked it. They used to have me get up in class all the time and recite it because I did it so well. So,
when you were growing up, did you speak primarily Spanish or English at home?
Oh, Spanish. No, we spoke Spanish all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I learned English in school, but at home we always spoke Spanish. Yeah.
Could you have stayed in Puerto Rico and acted?
Yes, I could have stayed in Puerto Rico and acted, but I don't think I would have had the exposure that I've had coming to New York. You know, I could have stayed there and acted, but I wouldn't have, I wouldn't have had the exposure
mm-hmm.
that I have here.
When you came to New York, and this was, what, in the early 60s, mid-60s?
I came to New York in the mid-60s, yeah.
How did you first present yourself to casting directors? And I mean this in the sense of that, so that you wouldn't be just typecast in certain kinds of stereotype Latin roles that Hollywood has become so famous for.
Yeah. Well, I was fortunate to meet people like Joe Papp, who really didn't see me as a stereotype, but saw that I had a feeling for Shakespeare and a love for Shakespeare. And he liked the way I interpreted Shakespeare. He's one of those people that doesn't think that Shakespeare can only be done by Englishmen, including some critics. And so I was very fortunate about that. I just met the right people at the right time.
What were the first movie roles that you were offered?
The first movie role that I was offered was in Stiletto. I come in at a party. I play a prince, I think. I remember I had a white dinner jacket. I come and I say hello. And this is Prince something of the something. And I say goodbye. And that's the end of the role. That was my first role, yeah.
Uh-huh.
In a film called Stiletto.
In the mid-70s, I think it was, you became involved with Est, the Werner Erhard group, and also with his group, The Hunger Project, which is dedicated to stopping world hunger. I was wondering if you're still involved with both groups.
Well, yeah, I participated in both, yeah. I haven't been able to participate so much. It's not, the Est training has been retired. And now something evolved out of it called the Forum. And I haven't been able to participate I've been so busy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever I can, I do. And the Hunger Project is something that I participate with constantly, all the time. And it's something that I've been with it since its inception in 1977. And it's something that I'm totally committed to.
Has your work with, your earlier work with Est or with the Hunger Project helped you as an actor?
Oh, well, definitely, because these things, you see, as an actor, I am the instrument. I don't have a violin, I don't have a piano, I don't have brushes to paint. You know, I don't have plaster to sculpt. The instrument for an actor is his himself. So anything that deals with the self and the individual is a training into getting to master yourself and know yourself, and not only for life, which can be very helpful for life too, but also as an actor, to work on myself is essential. So anything that I find that is working on yourself and or your emotions, your personality, whatever, I try. And Est was very helpful about that.
Your weight has changed from movie to movie, depending on what the role is. You know, I've seen you, for instance, in Kiss of the Spider Woman, in which you're nearly emaciated, and in Tequila Sunrise, in which you're, you know, much, you have a much fuller figure. Do you have to keep changing weights depending on the role that you're playing?
Well, sometimes I don't have to. Sometimes I'm in the right weight for the role. Sometimes I don't have to change weights at all. But sometimes I like to, just to, because it's part of the role, and part of creating a role is the outward look of the role, the physical look of the character. So sometimes I do change weight.
Do you find yourself changing your accent and your speech patterns depending on the role? For
yes.
instance, speaking differently for Romero than you would for Kiss of the Spider Woman, or
yes.
compromising positions, you know?
definitely. Yeah, it might not be a noticeable as much to an audience as it is to me, but each, I find that most characters, with exceptions, speak differently. A lot of just little nuances, little pronunciations here and there that are just for my own, it's my own thing, so that gives me an idea, more of a feeling for the character. Sometimes I change my speech patterns very subtly, but I do change them.
We only have a few seconds left, but could you give us a sense of how you changed your speech to play Oscar Romero?
Oscar Romero was a very straightforward, very honest man, very direct. So his speech is like that. His voice is like that. It's all coming from truth. So I got that from listening to him speak, and then I have to incorporate it within myself and use that from myself, you know. Use, when I speak like that, to use that all the time for Romero.
Well, Raul Julia, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Raul Julia can be seen in the new film Mac the Knife, and his film Romero will be out on video in March. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones. He brings his athlete's body and training to his dance movements. And though his partner, Arnie Zane, died of AIDS 2 years ago, Jones keeps his name in the title of the dance company. I hope you can join us.
I've heard them praising single-minded spirits whose empty stomachs show they live for knowledge. In rat-infested shacks awash with knowledge. I'm all for culture, but there are some limits. The simple life is fine for those it suits. I don't find for my part that it attracts. There's not a bird from here to Halifax. Woodpecker, such an appetite.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The plot against Harry is the story of a small-time gangster who goes legit by buying into his ex-brother-in-law's catering business. It's also the story of Harry's alienation from his middle-class Jewish family. No one laughed 20 years ago when the film was made. No one released the film either. But now Harry's getting laughs and good reviews. Coming up, we meet the writer and director, Michael Romer. And there's another mini-series based on America's most prominent political family. Television critic David Bianculli previews The Kennedys of Massachusetts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. It's the middle of the night in South Africa, where a crowd of supporters continues its vigil outside the home in Soweto of Nelson Mandela. Some of the people have been there since Saturday. Mandela is not expected in Soweto until tomorrow, when a huge rally is planned. On his first full day of freedom after 27 years in prison, Mandela defended the policies of his African National Congress, but said talks with the government can be held soon. In Washington today, President Bush said that it's too early to talk about lifting U.S. sanctions against South Africa, but called the release of Nelson Mandela a dramatic sign. In Europe, the mayor of East Berlin resigned today after repeated charges that he rigged local elections last year. Deidre Berger reports.
East Berlin Mayor Eberhard Kronk today accepted responsibility for falsified election results in his city last year. Immediately after local elections were held nationwide last spring, East German opposition leaders charged they were rigged. But state prosecutors first opened investigations into the matter the past few weeks. Meanwhile, in Leipzig tonight, reunification, not corruption, continues to dominate the weekly Monday night demonstration. Tens of thousands demanded immediate action on the question of reunification. There are also calls for the introduction of the West German mark and demands for united German elections by the end of the year. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger reporting.
A political crisis in Greece continues, where the leaders of the country's three main parties decided to withdraw their ministers from office. Prime Minister Zoulitas will run the country with a caretaker cabinet until a general election in April. From Athens, Malcolm Brabant reports.
Greece is rapidly inheriting Italy's former reputation as the most politically unstable country in Western Europe. The country has been in turmoil since June last year. There have been two inconclusive general elections, resulting in two short-term coalition administrations that have collapsed because of fundamental ideological differences. The all-party government of conservatives, socialists, and communists that resigned today had been set up after November's election, in which the conservatives failed by just two seats to secure an overall majority. Today's developments will be used by the conservative leader, Konstantin Mitsotakis, to support his claim that coalition governments don't work in Greece. He says Greece is steadily sinking into the mire, turning into a third world country, while Eastern Europe is going through world-shaking changes. For National Public Radio, this is Malcolm Brabant in Athens.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 29 points to close at 2,619.14, on volume of some 118 million shares. Trading was very light, as declining issues led advances by more than 2-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. 20 years ago, Michael Romer made a film called The Plot Against Harry. It was a comedy, but no one laughed at the time, so Romer never released it. The film was shown for the first time last fall at the New York Film Festival, and audiences loved it. Last month, the film opened in New York. The Plot Against Harry centers around Harry Plotnick, a small-time numbers racketeer alienated from the values of his estranged middle-class Jewish family. The film opens as Harry gets out of jail. He accidentally runs into his ex-wife and her brother, who runs a failing catering business. Harry attempts to go legit and enters into a partnership in the catering business. Before making The Plot Against Harry, Romer and his partner cinematographer Robert Young made the film Nothing But a Man, about a black couple in the South. I had read that after making Nothing But a Man, Romer wondered how well he captured the life of Southern blacks, being neither black nor Southern himself. He made The Plot Against Harry because he wanted to make a film closer to his own experiences. Okay, so Romer and Harry Plotnick are both Jewish, but what's the connection between a Harvard-educated filmmaker and an ex-con? I asked Romer to explain.
Well, you know, there's an old affinity between so-called artists, filmmakers, writers, poets, painters, who I think often feel themselves to be outsiders, and that part of the society that operates on the lam or on the outside, namely, you know, if not hoods and gangsters, well, confidence artists and people like that. So I think that I felt close to someone who was on the outside and trying to make it in and, you know.
Well, your movie is from the point of view of a small-time criminal's view of the Jewish middle class. Now, you were a different kind of outsider in a way because you emigrated to the United States with no family, I believe, after the Holocaust. You grew up, I believe, in Germany and went to England during the war and then came to the States when you were a teenager. Can you tell me how you were sent to England on the children's transport? Who was chosen and how?
I don't know how the administration of those things worked. I know that late in 38 and then until September 39, when hostilities actually broke out and it all had to stop, parents in Germany became very, very alarmed, for very good reason, of course, and they started to look for any way to get their children out, even if they themselves couldn't get out. And there were these trains, I think there were 10,000 children all in all who went out that way, who went from Berlin, and I think some from Vienna as well, to England. We went through Holland, and it was a train full of children, in my case, with some accompanying adults, 300 children on our train. And the parents just, you know, said goodbye at the railroad stations in Berlin and went on to... Some of them went on to the next station. There are a lot of stations in these big European cities. And just to see the train go through one more time and to wave to the train, I didn't know that at the time. I didn't even look out the window, I don't think. But I know my mother said she was standing at the next station waving to the train as it went by. It's a heartbreaking image if one thinks that a great many parents never, of course, saw their children again because they died. No, the children never saw their parents again.
Did you have any idea why you were being sent away?
Vague, very vague. I knew about anti-Semitism. I mean, I was, in a very small, personal way, victimized by German kids on our street who had been my friends who suddenly turned on me because I was Jewish. But and I knew that my family was very upset, and my mother, my grandparents, and that the business they were in was being dismantled and destroyed. And but, you know, all I remember is that I was told to pack, and the next thing I remember is hoarding chocolate and putting endless bars of chocolate into my suitcase, and going to the train station. That's how I remember it. And then I remember a tremendous sense of relief as soon as we crossed the German border, so I must have understood something.
So you spent the war years in England.
Yeah, I was in a school mostly for refugee children in England. A wonderful school, a really marvelous boarding school that is still, in many ways, my family. Children who went to that school with me, and even the adults, I'm still in touch with some of them. And it is like a family, you know. For 6 years I lived very intensively with 120 other children or a great many of them without parents. And
how did you come to the States?
Well, my mother actually got out in 1941, and she went to Portugal, and then from Portugal to the United States. And so when the war was drawing to its end, they permitted a certain number of the children to rejoin family in the United States. And that's how my sister and I actually got out.
In your movie, The Plot Against Harry, who's the guy who runs the numbers racket, he decides to go legit and goes into a catering business with his ex-brother-in-law, Leo. And so this is a catering business that specializes in bar mitzvahs and weddings.
Right.
And it strikes me that you probably didn't have an extended family in the States who were always inviting you to bar mitzvahs and weddings and stuff.
No, this was, of course, partly, again, I think you're quite astute. I've never thought of that part of it, but I think you've put your finger on something that is probably psychologically there, that I didn't have any of those things, and that I was the Harry who was trying to join it. You know, if that's what you were getting at, that's absolutely true. And of course, the whole East European community, East European Jewish community, was what I would look at with longing, with all its festivities and its sense of family. You know, German Jewish family is very German. It's not only German, but it's very German, and it's. I was in a very small family, you know. There's no extended family that I remember at all, and very little sense of community. And so perhaps I think you're right to point out that I sort of adopted that as something I wanted to be part of, and that part of the story comes out of that, you know.
There were obviously things you found very touching that you yearned for about these extended family, big catered affairs. What did you find absurd about them?
Oh, well, that's the other side of it. Of course, as an outsider, you it's not only that you want to be part of it, but you also kind of look at it with a slightly jaundiced eye, you know. First of all, you're not part of it, so you're already a little critical of it, you know. Another thing is that almost all human activity, including probably this broadcast, if you get far enough away from it, gets to be a little bit funny. I mean, we're so intense about everything we do, and if you step away from it and you look at human beings, and there are, you know, 5 billions of us, you know, all of us so intense about whatever we do, we're funny. And I think that's what I find absurd. It's not the catering business that I find absurd. It's just all human activity that gets intense, including my own. I mean, I'm incredibly intense. Filmmaking is incredibly intense. It's absurd, you know, but it's also great.
My guest is Michael Romer, director of the film The Plot Against Harry. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Filmmaker Michael Romer is my guest. Now, the way I understand what happened is when you first showed the plot against Harry to friends, to potential backers, to film executives, nobody laughed, right?
That's right.
Now everybody realizes that, you know, the film's gotten a wonderful reception. People think it's really pretty funny. What is it about the movie, or about your sense of humor as conveyed through the movie, that people didn't get then and that they do get now?
I wish I knew. I mean, everyone has been wondering about that, and I've said that I thought part of the problem was that originally the film moved too fast, which is true. At the time, 20 years ago, people couldn't pick up the information quickly enough. That was part of it. I think another part of it has to do with distance again, you know? If it's your own time and your own place and your own activity, it's harder to see the thing as funny. When you look from a distance, and that could be a distance in time, 20 years, then the things that seemed just photographic reality acquire a slightly different tonality, perhaps. Again, distance may have something to do with it. I know Chaplin once said that comedy happens in long shots, and maybe, you know, time can make a long shot out of something that was once a close-up. It's a possibility. I honestly don't know. A third possibility could be that we are much more comfortable with ethnicity than we used to be, and that people were a little bit nervous or a little bit sensitive to the fact that this is a Jewish community that isn't already in the suburbs and lawyers and, you know, doctors and professors, but these are just ordinary, plain, middle-class and even lower middle-class people. And they're just like every other ethnic community that's working its way into the middle class.
Can I offer another possibility, too?
Please do. I'll use it the next interview.
That I think the generation that was growing up while you were making the movie was a generation that grew up maybe slightly more alienated from their
absolutely.
Extended family.
I think that's absolutely part of it. And I think the film does speak to them, these younger people today, in just that way. I think there were people, perhaps already like me, as I was then, you know, who are now looking back at that period and enjoying the fact that there's an outsider being at a bar mitzvah when perhaps they were just a little bit outside their own bar mitzvahs. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that that's true, but it could be. I think that there is such a generation, perhaps.
You taught for many years. Are you still teaching?
Yeah. I still teach. I started before we started making Harry. I was asked to teach at Yale, and since I'd made so many movies just trying to make a living, this seemed like a very good alternative to making films I didn't want to make just to keep, you know, our three children halfway closed and fed. And so I've been teaching for the last, since 1966, and I still teach.
Now that the plot against Harry has not only been released, but is really a wonderful success, what kind of offers are you getting now?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's a little early, of course, but everything that people have talked to me about so far is, as always, and you know, I've had this experience on several occasions before, people have projects and they'd like to hire you to direct their films, or possibly to adapt a book that they've bought the rights to. And my own experience is that I'm not really as good as many other people in doing that kind of thing, and that I need to stick with my own material and do that. So I haven't ever directed someone else's script. All my films, starting with Nothing But a Man and ending with Haunted, I have written the scripts myself. And so those are the kinds of offers that I've had since, you know, in the last 3 or 4 weeks. Jim Jarmusch, who after Stranger Than Paradise, said that he had the same experience. People didn't call him and say, "What would you like to do next?" They said, "We'd like you to," and then they told him what they wanted him to do. I think that's generally the experience. We independent filmmakers, if they have any kind of success, as we did Nothing But a Man, and as I do now, get to be members of a club who are allowed to direct films, but we're not necessarily allowed to do the films we want to make.
Do you have screenplays that are already written in your drawer, ready to go?
Yep, I always think if opportunity knocks, I'll have the door open before they finish knocking. I keep writing stories, and I don't go out and hustle money anymore. I've done that, but at this time, I'm unwilling to spend a year or a year and a half as I did for my last film, you know, just raising money. So I'm hoping that perhaps a miracle will happen again, as indeed it did with the plot against Harry. I mean, somebody literally came, man from Seattle, King Broadcasting, and said, "We liked your last film. What would you like to do?" And so we made Harry.
One of the pleasures of The Plot Against Harry is the way it was cast. The actors in it, none of them have become famous. And you have the pleasure of watching all these really interesting faces and interesting actors who you haven't already mentally typecast. Do you know what I mean? Because you haven't seen them in other roles.
Sure. That's the great advantage of not having famous actors, is that if they're good, they have that wonderful immediate, you know, they don't have, you're not watching a marvelous, well-known actor do this particular part. you're watching somebody who you could almost think is that person, you know.
Right. Did you use any cheap but innovative casting techniques?
No, none of the techniques. They were all cheap because my time was worthless. I mean, I was, you know, it didn't cost anything, but innovative? No, I went to, I was really obliged to go to many amateur theatrical groups, mostly attached to temples, to see whether there was some amateur talent that I could find. And I did find, probably 10 or 15 actors that way. You know, Jewish people are pretty good actors. I mean, they really have a mimetic gift. And so that part was great fun. And perhaps it was innovative, but it was simply a matter of necessity.
I thought that this interview was going to end with me knowing what the next film of yours I could look forward to was going to be. But I guess maybe that's not going to be the ending of this interview.
I don't have any idea. It depends whether someone wants to do one of my scripts, and perhaps someone does.
Well, how hard are you going to push for that?
Well, that's a good question. If pushing means going around and trying to talk people into doing something, I probably won't push at all. If it means being very ready to do it and very capable of doing it and meeting with someone who is interested in doing it, I'd push very hard. But I don't think I'll probably push hard in the 23-year-old sense.
Filmmaker Michael Romer. His movie, The Plot Against Harry, is showing in New York, Los Angeles, Boston, San Francisco, and Chicago. Here's a scene from The Plot Against Harry at a bar mitzvah catered by Harry's ex-brother-in-law, Leo.
This you gotta see, Harry.
Ladies and gentlemen, our candlelight ceremony. As I call your names, please join the bar mitzvah boy and his parents. Grandma and Grandpa Levinson. Grandma Spiegelberg. Great Aunt Rivka. Uncle Benjamin. Aunt Zora and Uncle Milton.
It's beautiful, huh? It stays with them the rest of their lives.
Miss Ella Watson. The Waxman family. Mrs. Helen Shapiro.
Okay, Harry. You got a deal. 30-70. So I won't get rich. So what?
Listen, I might need like an office with a phone.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Linda Wertheimer. Linda, what stories do you have from South Africa one day after the release of Nelson Mandela?
Terry, we have Mandela's news conference this morning in Cape Town, and then he's departed for Johannesburg and is expected to come to Soweto. We'll review the speech, which was a major political statement, a kind of a manifesto for Mandela, and we'll analyze it. And look at the South Africa he sees now in 1990 and what it was like when he went to prison in 1962. And then we have some milestones, Terry. The oldest senator is going to run for re-election, Strom Thurmond. The inventor of Velcro died, and the home of Gilbert and Sullivan, the Savoy Theater, burned.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If TV miniseries are any indication, the Kennedy family remains an American obsession. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of a new 6-hour miniseries about the Kennedy clan, which begins Sunday night.
This new ABC miniseries is based on Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, The Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys. Now, the Fitzgeralds in their time were as powerful and prominent as the Kennedys, but here the Fitzgeralds are not only denied top billing, they're denied billing at all. It's now called The Kennedys of Massachusetts. Instead of starting with the rise of Rose Kennedy's father, Boston Mayor John Fitzgerald, this TV drama begins when Rose first meets Joe Kennedy at a party in 1906.
I saw your picture in the paper on your graduation.
Oh, yes.
It's not every girl who has her picture in the newspapers getting a high school diploma.
It's not every girl who has it presented to her by the mayor. I think that might have had something to do with it, don't you?
I wouldn't be surprised.
that bit about you displaying, what was it? A depth and strength of intelligence seldom found in so young a woman. Is that true?
Strength of mind, I believe it was. Well, I suppose I'd like to think that was true. Is.
The miniseries stays with Joe and Rose and their offspring for the next 55 years and climaxes with John Fitzgerald Kennedy's inauguration. That means the actors playing Joe and Rose have to age as well as act convincingly, and William L. Peterson and Annette O'Toole do a really good job. It's somewhat surprising, because O'Toole's biggest credit is as Lana Lang in Superman 3, and Peterson is better known for his roles in action films, including the movie To Live and Die in L.A. and the terrific TV comedy Long Gone. Other cast members include Charles Durning as John Fitzgerald, Tracy Pollan as Kathleen, a little-known Kennedy daughter nicknamed Kick, and, as other Kennedy offspring, Campbell Scott as Joe Jr., Randall Mell as Bobby, and Stephen Weber as JFK. A lot of the famous Kennedy names and faces, though, are notable by their total or relative absence. Jackie Kennedy, for example, is seen only for a second in a montage and doesn't have a single line of dialogue. Ted Kennedy is basically overlooked, too, as is almost anyone in the family who's still alive and, presumably, still able to sue on their own behalf. Between their absence and some obvious cost-cutting in the TV production, a lot of important events are summarized in letters and dialogue rather than dramatized. In this scene, Rose reads to the family a newspaper account of Jack's exploits during World War II.
The Navy and Marine Corps Medal has been awarded to Lieutenant John F. Kennedy, son of Joseph P. Kennedy, former ambassador to Great Britain, for extremely heroic conduct.
When his PT boat was cut in half and sunk by a Japanese destroyer, the Navy said tonight. And then there's the story of the whole action, which I have a hunch you all know by heart by now.
Brother, you can say that again.
That's for sure. A whole movie, PT-109, was made about that one mission. And if you wanted to, you could easily fill in the gaps in the Kennedys of Massachusetts by referring to such TV docudramas as Young Joe the Forgotten Kennedy, Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy, and, simply, Kennedy. Then, picking up where this miniseries leaves off, you could conclude with The Missiles of October. William Hanley's teleplay has other gaps. It downplays Joe Kennedy Sr.'s alleged bootlegging, for example, and a lot of other things that might have been in there when this six-hour miniseries was originally planned at 11 hours. Even so, director Lamont Johnson gets performances, not caricatures, from most of his cast members. The Kennedys of Massachusetts isn't complete or completely satisfying, but it is compelling.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. We'd like to welcome the listeners of WJFF, a new station in Jeffersonville, New York. Today's Fresh Air was co-produced by Danny Miller and Fred Landerl. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones tells us about his longtime collaboration with Arnie Zane and how he's carried on after Zane's death from AIDS. Also, journalist Ida Bari and Jerry tracks down the man who killed her grandfather. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air. I've been here a long time, and I know what it takes to keep the station on the air. It takes your call.